Welcome to another edition of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, and I am joined, as always, by the definite article, Chad Bird. What's going on, Chad?
Hey, how you doing, Dan?
I'm good.
You ready to do some Exodus?
I'm ready to do it. Let's Exodus this up.
Yeah, I think we're going to get plagued here pretty quick. Mm. We're not quite there, but we're gonna jump headfirst into plagues here, I think in chapter 7. So we're kind of lead up to that and maybe get into a little bit of Nile turning into blood today. We'll see how things go.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, so last time we focused quite a bit on the opening section, first section of chapter 6 of Exodus. And this is after things went very poorly for Moses and Aaron. They went to meet with Pharaoh, and Pharaoh took away the straw from the Israelite brickmakers. And anyway, it ended up just kind of being a really mess for Moses and Aaron. Things did not go at all like they had intended. In fact, they went worse. So God, Moses goes to God and complains basically. And says, every since I got down here, things have only become worse. So what's up? And then God, in these opening verses of chapter 6, reassures Moses and tells Moses that, look, everything is going to work out. I am the Lord. That's one of the recurring phrases in this section. I am Yahweh, meaning I am the God who is going to be with you and is going to work for you and is going to bring about your ultimate redemption. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying it's going to be fast. I'm not saying it's going to work according to the way you think it should, but I am Yahweh, and I will deliver you and redeem you and bring you all the way to the land that I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So there's a speech that God gives to Moses in order to strengthen him in his weakening faith and to give him some hope in the midst of his growing despair. So you would think then, maybe because of all of this divine speech, that the next verse would say something like, and Moses took all these words of the Lord to the people, and they were greatly encouraged. But picking up here where we left off, that isn't quite what happened. So when God stops speaking at the end of verse 8 in chapter 6, we have this in verse 9. So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel. In other words, he told the Israelites everything that God had just told him. But they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and cruel bondage. That's not a very encouraging word to preachers, huh?
No, it's not.
It doesn't always go the way that you think or want it to go. The Hebrew there for despondency, that's what my translation has, is literally it's shortness of spirit. It's this idea that, you know, a lengthy spirit or enlarged spirit would be full of hope and open to the promises of God, but shortness of spirit is, I guess we might even translate it something like depression, the literal sense of depression, that this idea of being pressed down to be made smaller. So the idea is that their spirit was made smaller, was pressed down, and because of the cruel bondage. In other words, just because these good words were spoken to them, words of promise and words of hope from the mouth of God himself, did not necessarily mean that this was going to really hit home with the Israelites, because sometimes people are trapped in a situation where, at least for the time being, when they hear the gospel or when they hear any of the Lord's words of hope, it doesn't immediately give them that kind of hope or that kind of forward-looking faith that we want it to. That's just human nature. People are sometimes going to have to be brought along to another place where that word will begin to actually work what God intends it to work in their hearts.
Yeah, the ESV translates that because of their broken their broken spirit or their brokenness of spirit, mm-hmm. because and harsh slavery. Which I mean, it's, as you read it, it's sort of discouraging, but in an odd way, it's also encouraging because I think lots of people have been in that spot where the promises of God don't seem to be impacting you or giving you hope the way that they should because you're in such a broken condition. Maybe it's your own fault or maybe it's not. It can be either one. You can be in a broken condition. You could be low in spirit or broken in spirit because of your own sin and the ramifications of that, or because of somebody else's and that you have nothing to do with. But either way, when you're sort of in that depths of despair, sometimes the promises of God don't just immediately lift you up out of it.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's so important that those words of hope and consolation continue to be spoken. Because even though they might not make the impact on us or on those we love immediately, they still need to hear them. It's this ongoing expression of God's fidelity to us, of hope for the future that we need to hear, so that even though we may not feel the reaction that we want or experience the kind of increase in hope that we wish that we could, over time that word does its work. It doesn't return to God void. It accomplishes that for which he sent it. You know, we tend to be slow learners and slow listeners, slow hearers. And so God continually comes to us. And sometimes it's just like he's a broken record saying the same thing over and over and over to us. But that's what we need. And eventually this word does its work. Now with the Israelites, it'll take some time, but they will get there. But for now, there's going to be a lengthy interlude between what is God is saying to them now, and then finally when they will actually begin to hope again, because we got a whole series of plagues between then and now. So we have that verse, and then what follows is this. God again speaks to Moses. He reiterates what he's already said. He says, go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of his land. And Moses complains. He says to God, look, the sons of Israel haven't listened to me. How then will Pharaoh listen to me? Because I am unskilled in speech. So it's a legitimate complaint Moses makes. He's like, listen, even my own people won't listen to me. There's no way that Pharaoh is going to listen to me. But God is unrelenting. God says to Moses and to Aaron, his brother, he gave them a charge. So he commissioned them. He charged them to speak to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So, in other words, just because the people of Israel wouldn't listen because of their despondency and brokenness of spirit, and just because Pharaoh wouldn't listen because of his hardness of heart and increasing hardness of heart, did not mean that Moses was somehow not supposed to say anything else. I think that's an important point too, that just because a person doesn't seem to be listening to us, or in fact seems to be rejecting the word that we speak, doesn't mean that we stop speaking. God says, continue to speak to the sons of Israel, continue to speak to Pharaoh. It doesn't matter if you're unskilled in speech. It doesn't matter if they don't seem to be listening. Continue to utter my word, and my word, when the time comes, will work that for which I sent it. And it's going to be different in the case of Pharaoh, and it's going to be different for the children of Israel, but his word will have the effect that he wants it to have. And sometimes, you know, we can't control when that happens. We can't control the effect that it has on people, but we can control the ongoing speaking of that word and letting the word do its work.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. In my translation here, it has "I am of uncircumcised lips," yeah. which is obviously you don't circumcise your lips. That's not a thing. So he's obviously using that as a metaphor for something else, being unskilled in speech, but. But that phrase is interesting because it means that God has not touched his weakness, and that he has not lifted that from him. And I feel like there's sort of this, how am I going to tell Pharaoh when, I'm of uncircumcised lips. In other words, like I still sort of have like this speech affliction. What would have been helpful is if I didn't, suck at talking, which I told you about, by the way.
Yeah. By way of reminder, I told you this back in the burning bush, right?
Yeah, there's nothing I could do about it. So like, if you would just circumcise my lips, I think what's happening here is he's saying like, if you would, place your blessing on my speech, right? I mean, this is what circumcision is. It's the physical sign of the covenant of God and the blessing of God. And so when he says my lips are uncircumcised, it's saying that like they apparently don't have that. They don't have that blessing. They don't have that promise because I still stumble over my words.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As you were talking, it reminded me a lot of Paul's complaint too. Three times I begged the Lord to take away this thorn in the flesh, and yet God won't do it. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And oh my goodness, we could come up with a million examples of that in our own lives and in the lives of other people. If only I could do this better. If only I didn't have this weakness. If only I didn't have this physical defect. If only I didn't have this spiritual defect. If only I were like somebody else, then everything would be okay. So why don't you do it, God? And God's response is always the same: My power is made perfect in weakness. Because God chooses uncircumcised lips, or He chooses the various weaknesses and afflictions and thorns in the flesh from which we suffer, in order to work through those, because God is the kind of God who likes to put His strength in weakness, who likes to put His glory in suffering, who ultimately likes to work life for all creation in the death of Himself on the cross.
Yeah.
So He's always working through that which we wish that He wouldn't work through. Just make us perfect and full of strength and beautiful and all these other things that we admire. And God says, no, that's not the way I work.
Yeah,
I work through uncircumcised lips.
Yeah. We all want to be like, just make us like Saul and everything will be great.
Everything will be great.
If we could all just be 6'4", ripped up, good speakers, handsome dudes, like that would be like, then people, then we got done. Then it'd be easy.
Yeah.
That's not how he goes. But I think that it's this a lot of times this isn't just like spiritual stuff. I mean, this is like actual physical stuff. So I mean, I think even in the case of Paul, I mean, some people say like thorn in the flesh, and they sort of take that as maybe you do, Chad. I don't know, but they'll take that as sort of like thorn in the flesh in the spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. So it's like some temptation he struggles with or something like that. I don't think that's what it is. I think it's talking about thorn in the flesh as in like the actual flesh, much like this. Mm-hmm. This is a thorn in Moses's actual flesh. Like he's not, maybe he has a stutter, maybe he has a speech impediment, maybe he just isn't great, he's not quick with his words, whatever it is, but it's a physical thing that makes it difficult physically. And I think Paul's was too. I subscribe to the that Paul, there's something was severely wrong with Paul's eyesight, and not just like, I have a hard time seeing, but like had some kind of like messed up like eye infection kind of thing going on. I mean, you see in some epistles where he talks about that he was like tough to look at, and that text where he talks about, you know, hey, you guys were awesome because you would have like pulled your eyeballs out of your head and like given them to me if you could. Mm-hmm. You have him saying, you know, hey, I wrote this letter because it was really important, but I wrote it with huge, you could tell I did because of the font that I used is like, you know, 80 font because I can't see anything. And I think that that's helpful. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it'd be, you know, you'd be like, oh, it'd be cool if like Paul was just like, you know, the thorn in the flesh, really struggled with this lust or whatever. I don't think it's that though, man. I think it's like, I think one of the reasons we don't want it to be this physical thing is because we're like, well, God would just heal that. But he doesn't. Like, he doesn't always do that. And that flies in the face of like sort of like this triumphant idea that we have that, God doesn't just touch Moses' lips and all of a sudden that whatever it is that he has going on, say it's a stutter. Like, he doesn't just like be like, oh, you're not going to have that anymore. He doesn't just say, you know what, Paul, it would be helpful if you weren't like, if your eyes weren't like oozing pus and you were disgusting to look at and you could actually, you know, like, I don't know, read stuff and you didn't have to have somebody else writing your letters for you. That would probably be more expedient. So practically speaking, that's better. Let's do it. Let's do that. He doesn't do that. Like he lets those things remain, which, so when we have something, even in our bodies, and we think like, man, serving God or just living life in this world or whatever it is, it'd be a lot easier if I didn't have this particular affliction, which is a real affliction. God does not promise like, yeah, in this life, I'm going to just go ahead and take that away and make it to where you don't have to deal with this anymore. Because, again, his strength is made perfect in weakness, right?
Yeah. I mean, over all of this, you could just lay the cross. That is the way that God works. He displays his ultimate love and grace and the way he works in the cross of his son. And then he continues to display it in the way that cross imprints our lives, whether that's through spiritual suffering or physical disabilities or whatever it is that deprives us of this perfect life that we, or perfect body that we think we need. That's just not the way that God works. And what tends to happen a lot of times when we do have this, you know, supposed perfection, whatever that might be, that we think we're really good at, it inflates our pride and ends up being our downfall anyway. So much better that God work through our weaknesses in order that we might be humbled and realize that he's actually the one doing the work and not us.
Yeah. You can go ahead and tell me now how I'm wrong about Paul.
Oh, no, I like your idea. I think it's all those examples that you gave about his eyesight are pretty convincing. I like the fact that he doesn't specifically say what it is.
Yeah.
So that it has kind of this universal applicability to us. You know, if he'd have said, you know, I asked you 3 times to heal my eyes, but you said no, that would certainly still have an impact on us. But that he chose kind of this metaphor of a thorn in the flesh, I think is helpful because that allows each of us, when we deal with whatever our thorns might be, to see ourselves in Paul's struggle. Yeah. I mean, I've got a whole list of things that I've asked God like 30 times to take away, and so far he hasn't. So I can sympathize with Paul. I'm still waiting, you know, for all these thorns to be taken away, but there they are, still in place.
Yep.
All right, so that finishes up 10 through 13. Now we've got, interestingly, we've got a genealogy of all things kind of thrown right here into the mix. It's verses 14 through 27 of chapter 6. And it's kind of an odd place, at least from my perspective, for a genealogy to be thrown in. I would think that a genealogy might be appropriate at the beginning of the book. Hey, let's kind of summarize who these people are and who the main character is going to be and who their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents are. But we wait until chapter 6. And I think this is significant. It's sort of an interlude a big parentheses that we have here to kind of, it connects us for one reason, it connects us with everything that we study in Genesis. So it starts out with the tribe of Reuben and then the tribe of Simeon. So the firstborn and the secondborn, and then it goes to Levi, and it's not a full genealogy. It says a little bit about the tribe of Reuben, a little bit of the tribe of Simeon. And then most of the genealogy, verses 16 through 27, are talking about the tribe of Levi. And the reason that is because Moses and Aaron were from the tribe of Levi. So this is kind of hey, let's pause for a second here and look back to where we came from so that we can better understand where we're at. So this is a way of bridging that gap once more from Genesis to Exodus, and telling us a little bit more about who Moses is and who Aaron is and how they kind of fit into this bigger story that this genealogy represents. And then we have to jump ahead a few verses to verse 7 of chapter 7. And we hear finally, not until this point, but finally we hear how old Moses is. Up to this point, we haven't been told. We hear that he's 80 years old, and his brother Aaron is a little bit older. He's 83. Now, I was thinking about this the other day, and I think it's kind of an interesting parallel here. So you've got kind of the opening story laid out here in the first 6.5 chapters, and then and only then do you have the genealogy of the main character presented, that of Moses. And then you hear about his age right before he goes into this 10-plague conflict with Pharaoh. And I got to thinking, you know what? That is parallel to some extent in the Gospel of Luke, because we kind of have the same pattern there. So the Gospel of Luke begins by telling us the story of Jesus. We hear about his birth and all of those things. And some of the first things that happened, but it's not until, I'm trying to get there in my Bible, it's not until chapter 3. So after all, we've already heard quite a bit about this opening story. It's not until chapter 3 that we get to the actual genealogy of Jesus. And then, also then, we're told his age, right before he goes into conflict with the devil during 40 days of temptation in the wilderness. So if you look at these two accounts, the Gospel of Luke and then Exodus, there's this kind of a structural, to me anyway, intriguing parallel. You have the opening story told about the main character, Moses and Jesus. Then you have the genealogy of Moses and Jesus. And then you have the age of both of them given, 80 in the case of Moses and 30 in the case of Jesus, right before they begin this major conflict with one with the devil and one with Pharaoh. I think it's an interesting example of how oftentimes the New Testament is imitating the Old Testament in ways that we might not be obvious right on the surface.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the New Testament starts with genealogy, which is totally, if you think about it in a, so I'm a musician, so I tend to think this way sometimes. I tend to think that if the New Testament is a song, it's a song that's written in the key of Old Testament, and it starts like that. So the first note in it is a genealogy in Matthew, and it stays on that trajectory. It's different. But it's in that same key.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. It really does. It sets the tone. It sets it immediately then connects you back to everything that went before it, so that you can hear the music the right way.
Yeah.
A few weeks ago at the church I attend, this was toward the beginning of Advent, so we're looking at early December. Our pastor, one of our pastors, when he began his sermon, He read that whole genealogy for Matthew. He warned us ahead of time. He's like, I'm gonna do something that I haven't done before. and you're going to get impatient, but just bear with me. And verse after verse, name after name, he read through that whole genealogy at the beginning of his sermon. And I was looking around the congregation, and people were fidgeting and looking at each other like, yeah, man, when is this ever going to be over? You know, it probably didn't take 2 minutes, but it felt like it was 15. And he had a great reason for doing it. He had a great point in doing that, in that he made us realize that this, one of the things this genealogy represents is how long the people of Israel had to wait for the Messiah to be born. So I do think that's one of the advantages of genealogies, even though we tend to skip or skim over them when we're reading the Bible, is they force us to slow down and to see the kind of the slow, methodical, patient way that God finally brings about his promises. You know, he doesn't, the firstborn of Eve is not the Messiah. He makes them wait a generation, then another generation, then another generation. And it kind of has that same point here, I think. It's a reminder, this genealogy in Exodus 6 is a reminder that, hey, you know, this redemption that God promised Abraham way back in Genesis 12, it's going to happen, but you had to wait a while, you know? You had to have this man father this son, and this father become a father himself, and then on down the line it goes until finally you have Moses and Aaron born, and they're going to be the instruments of God to bring about this redemption that Israel has been waiting for all these years.
Yeah. You see in the Bible, that's not just us, but yeah, even Adam, right? I mean, this goes way back to previous episodes, but yeah, even Adam, like, they have a son, and he's like, sweet deliverance.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Cain, he's going to be the one. He's the seed of the woman. He's going to crush the head of the serpent.
Not so much.
No. He ends up being a murderer, not a Messiah, does it? Doesn't always work out that way, but you have to admire their enthusiasm, right? They were ready for salvation. But God's like, no, we're going to, you're going to need to wait a while.
Yeah,
a
couple generations.
Couple generations, yeah. All right, so that's a genealogy. We have that spelled out for us, and that it's more or less the way that the chapter ends. We have kind of a reiteration of God telling Moses once more that I am Yahweh. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I speak to you. And once again, Moses complains of his uncircumcised lips. And that then leads us into chapter 7.
Does the amount of times that Moses brings this up seems to really drive home the point that, like, this is like a real insecurity for him.
Yeah, it is. I think you're right. This is the one complaint that he makes about his inability anyway. This is the one that comes up over and over and over. You know, it's interesting. He never complains about his age. No, he never says, you know, like when he was 80 when he was called to do this. He never said, "Hey, look, you know, I'm too old for this.
Right?
I can't do this. I mean, I've lived 8 decades. I'm ready to retire and move to Florida. I'm not going back to Egypt." But he never complains about that. You know, he talks about, you know, well, what am I supposed to tell him your name is? And I can't do this and blah, blah, blah. But the one thing that comes up over and over is the fact that he's not eloquent, that he has uncircumcised lips, that he's unskilled in speech, that he, you know, whatever it is, however he phrases it, it's always the same thing, that his rhetorical skills are woefully lacking or physically impaired in some way.
Yeah. I don't even get the sense that he's like, you know, that he's really afraid even. It's more, this job requires a certain amount of communication skills that I don't know if you know me, but I don't possess them. And again, we don't know what they are, but man, they must be pretty profound impediment here for it to be the thing that he keeps bringing up.
Yeah, must be. Well, it's a good example of how, you know, the things that we would never put on our resume if we were putting a resume to God, you know, and I have these skills, blah blah blah. But God doesn't look at those, and God doesn't consider the things we wouldn't ever put on there as somehow, you know, disqualifying us from that. God has a God looks beyond what we think are our strengths and weaknesses to see how he can truly use us. I mean, we all think, you know, I'm strong in this area. I'm weak in this area. And God very often comes through and he's like, I don't care about any of that. This is me. You know, I'm the one doing this. You're my instrument. And if I'm the one doing it, well, it doesn't matter what you think your strengths or weaknesses are. I'm going to be the one accomplishing it. You're going to be my hands and my feet and my mouth to bring that to pass. And it might not be pretty, but it's going to be effective. It's going to accomplish what I want it to accomplish.
Yeah. It's interesting, but the word of God is effective. It's epic. It does not lose its efficacy even when stuttered through. It's still that just shows you that it's God doing it.
That's right.
Not that a stutter is what's going on, but whatever it is.
I mean, you can have a preacher that's just, you know, like Chrysostom, Saint Chrysostom. Chrysostom means golden tongued. He's one of the most famously eloquent preachers in the history of the church. So you can have a Saint Chrysostom, but you can also have a Saint Moses. One is highly rhetorically skilled. One has some sort of speech problem, but God uses them both for the accomplishment of his will. Because ultimately it's not, you know, man's ability to put words together in some sort of pretty way that counts. It's man's word being baptized by the word of God. That is his words being God's words that issue forth and accomplish what God wants them to accomplish.
Yeah.
All right. So we're in chapter 7 now. So this is right after Moses gives his latest objection about Pharaoh not listening to him because he is uncircumcised of lips. And so here's how God responds. This is the Lord's answer to Moses' ongoing complaint. He says, look, I'm going to make you God to Pharaoh. And your brother, Aaron, I'm going to make him your prophet. So here's how it's going to work. You speak all that I command you, and then your brother Aaron is going to speak to Pharaoh that he should let the sons of Israel go out of his land. Now, this is a unique verse, couple of verses in the Bible, because to my knowledge, nowhere else in the Old or New Testament does this kind of very bold language occur. This maybe is God's final way of responding to Moses' complaint. You know, Moses is on and on complaining about the speech. And so finally, God says, look, Moses, I know about your speech impediment. I know about your uncircumcised lips. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you God to Pharaoh. And then Aaron's going to be your prophet. So just like I speak to a prophet and the prophet speaks to whoever he's sent to. So you're going to speak to Aaron and then Aaron is going to speak to Pharaoh for you. So that's the way it's going to work.
I like that. I'm going to make you as God to Pharaoh also means I'm going to make you like me to Pharaoh, which of course means he won't listen to you.
Yeah, right. It's not the outcome that we would expect when God
begins. because I don't know if you know this, people don't listen to me. Yeah.
God is the most ignored person in the world when it comes to people listening to him, right?
Yes.
I mean, we will listen. This just kills me. Some Hollywood star will say something, even though they have absolutely, maybe not absolutely, but little experience or training or whatever, you know what they're talking about. And so many people are just like oohing and aahing over this pronouncement that someone from Hollywood makes. And then God speaks in like, yeah, whatever.
We do this even in the church. Like when somebody famous becomes a Christian, all of a sudden, like we throw them in front of a microphone and we're like, "How do you explain the problem of evil?" And you're like, "What are you doing? This person's been saved for like a month. Like, what are you doing right now? Like, they're not an apologist. Like, what the heck? Like,
yeah.
Like, oh, they're famous. They probably got some like really divine insight on this. Like, what are you doing? Like, yeah."
No, they're just good at football.
Right. Yes.
They're just good at acting, or they're just good at whatever it is. Yeah, it is amazing to me how fame tends to lend credence to people, that all of a sudden, because they're good at this one thing that's made them famous, all of a sudden we assume that they are knowledgeable and good at all these other things as well. No, I mean, he can just catch a football really well. You know, she's great at acting in movies. But as far as, you know, knowing answers that have confounded the minds of people throughout the centuries, no, that's not the person to ask. It's a commentary, I think, on our idolization of people, especially famous people. We always expect more from them than they're ever willing to give. So, God is the one who's ignored. He's not the one who's listened to. And then we have, for at least a second time, if not a third time, the promise that God is going to harden Pharaoh's heart. That's what follows immediately after this. God says, Aaron will speak what you tell him to speak, but God says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt. This is not the kind of laying on of hands that people want. I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. So this is some pretty dire predictions that God is going to give. I like the fact that the heart of Pharaoh is hardened in order that God would multiply his signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. So this is going to be the fruit of Pharaoh's hardening of heart. God is going to work signs and wonders in the land of Egypt.
This is a tricky thing. You wonder, like, why you got to harden his heart? And ultimately, you see, like, a participation of Pharaoh in this when this goes down. So, like, God hardens his heart. Then you have other times where it'll say, like, Pharaoh hardened his heart. And so you have kind of this both-and thing happening. You do wonder, like, why, though? Like so you're going to bring all this, like, I mean, these things are terrible that you're gonna bring on them. And like, wouldn't it have been just easier if you didn't do that and you just, you know, or maybe you just like fast forward to, like, you know what it's going to end up taking. So maybe just like fast forward, take out Pharaoh's son, spoiler alert, you know, just right out of the gate. And then like, it's done. Like why you got to do all this stuff? And that's a question that I've been asked before, and you kind of wrestle around with it, like, you know, I mean, like, why you got to go through all this, like, to get to the point and the place that you want, that you're trying to get to.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is sort of right here, is that it's through this. Well, one, I think that the Passover is something that God really, really wants to establish and finds. Because of the Christology that goes along with it. But two, I think that this is one of the ways that God is going to sort of validate the message that Moses is bringing to the people as they're about to go out into the wilderness. All of the things that they're about to witness God do for their deliverance are going to, now they're still going to be forgetful. But I mean, can you imagine if it wasn't like that? It's just Moses like, let my people go. And Pharaoh's like, all right, we'll let you go. And they just, they'd be back, you know, 30 minutes into their journey. They'd be like, forget this. Like, you know, like how do we know? Like all of these things are our God does to bolster the confidence of the Jews leaving Egypt. These are things that are going to be sung about and talked about for, there's to this day. I mean, for the rest of Jewish history, certainly in the Old Testament, certainly the Red Sea is like that. And the Red Sea is also, like, there's a ton of imagery that goes on there. So there is this, I think, thing where God is going to, and we'll get into the plagues and how that relates to Christ and all this sort of thing, but there's a lot going on there. But I do think that part of it is just to show his people that he is God, and also the lengths that he will go to deliver them.
Yeah, very good. We have a lot more to say, but I think we're out of time.
Yeah, look at that. I just took a. I don't know where you were going. I just
that was a good way to. That was a good way to end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now you can look forward to us trying to tie all those things into what I just said.
Yeah, there you go. It'll give us a good goal to strive toward.
There you go. All right. Well, I guess it didn't get too plaguey this week, but I think we're guaranteed to get plaguey next week, Chad.
The plagues are coming next week, so prepare yourself now.
Yeah. Batten the hatches. It's coming. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us. Hey, if you are interested in hanging out with me and Chad at a conference in October and a whole bunch of other people, you can do that. The Here We Still Stand conference in San Diego. Tickets are at the cheap rate right now. Won't stay there forever. Those continue to go up, and there aren't an unlimited amount of them. So if you want to go, I recommend getting over there, get that ticket. You can figure out your travel later, and get a spot reserved. You can come hang out with me and Chad and a whole host of other people. Go to herewestillstand.org, and you can check out the schedule and all the people that are going to be there and what's going to go on. So, yeah. All right, guys, we'll see you next week.